welcome to We Dig Metal Evolution, a special Let It Roll maxi series discussing Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution documentary series hosted by Nate Wilcox with Eugene S. Robinson of the art punk band Oxbow and entertainment lawyer Alexi Auld. Let It Roll is the insanely ambitious musical history podcast. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi discuss progressive metal from King Crimson through Rush and Dream Theater through the post-grunge acts like Tool and Mastodon. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we're back again with Alexi Auld and Eugene S. Robinson to continue our discussion of Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution series that aired on VH1 a few years back. The 11th episode focuses on progressive metal, which lets Dunn cover some of his 21st century favorites like Mastodon and Meshuggah, and that necessitates a trip down memory lane to incorporate the history of British prog rock and early prog metal pioneers like Rush, Queensryche, and Dream Theater. So, this is the last episode of the official VH1 series. For some reason, they did 11. I mean, who does 11 shows and not...
It goes up to 11.
Well, fitting. So there's a crowdfunded episode, though, on extreme metal, which, to me, was all the stuff I wanted to hear about. So I'm glad that they went back and do this, because a history of metal with no death metal, no black metal, no grindcore, not a history of metal. But I guess VH1... wanted to sell advertising. So we've got progressive metal, which to me is kind of a kludge. He starts out with Mastodon, yes, which I was introduced to as a doom metal band. But when I heard him, I was like, they're kind of fancy proggy stuff, but not the kind of prog that made my hair fall out and gave me nosebleeds. Like Dream Theater and Queensryche, which I've actually gone and listened to for the first time to prepare for this show. So taking it for the team.
I was so happy after watching this episode. I was so happy. I was happier than I've ever been.
We heard you complaining about it last time.
That was anticipatory complaining. After I watched it, I realized there was a problem with how he put it together, but I'll get into it later.
Okay. So, but he starts with Mastodon, late 90s, early 21st century band coming out of Atlanta, features them as, you know, a band he likes, a significant band, popular band. I definitely heard about him even after I had tuned out all hard rock. And then zeroes right in on their influences, and they lead with Genesis, Yes, and King Crimson, quote, all that good stuff. But if you listen to Mastodon, they don't sound like a prog rock band. They sound like a metal band with prog elements, you know. But then he gets into, so he's like, Prague, and then this is a classic Sam Dunn quote. So I'm doing this series on a history of heavy metal. I never imagined I'd be exploring British prog rock. The music to me is more connected to flutes and mythology and distorted guitar, but it turns out a lot of metal musicians were influenced by bands like King Crimson and Yes and Genesis. Other than the flutes, I mean, mythology and distorted guitar is metal, right? I mean,
and also there are plenty of places you can get into a fist fight for mentioning King Crimson with Yes and Genesis. Serious King Crimson heads are like, I don't know what you're talking about. Genesis and Yes are very different from King Crimson.
I think I ought to move down your mic, Eugene, so people can hear more of what you're talking about.
Thank you, Alex.
There you go.
Yeah, and we'll get into that when we talk about it. But, you know, you could say the same thing about Genesis being different from Yes and King Crimson. But there are people who like King Crimson that don't like any of the other prog bands of that era. Right. And I admit I've been in that camp myself. Although different, there's multiple different iterations of King Crimson. In this one, they're mostly talking about the 1969 iteration with Robert Fripp and Greg Lake, who later goes on to form Emerson, Lake & Palmer. And the thing they don't get into is that King Crimson hit hard, was big, and then completely disintegrated on their first tour. But had they stayed together, they would have been bigger than all the prog bands put together, I think, because their first American tour, I mean, it was just doing banner business. It was like not quite Led Zeppelin level, but comparable, and you know, getting accolades, and they were big and heavy. But they lead with Genesis, actually, and they go talk to Steve Hackett, and Genesis's influences on metal apparently boils down to tapping, which I think is fair. It was a big deal for Eddie Van Halen, etc., and Steve Hackett did do it first. So, but pretty thin gruel. And they show plenty of Peter Gabriel dressed as a flower and, you know, the silly stuff. But yeah. But I've actually gone back and listened to the early Genesis albums. I still haven't made it to Lamb Lies Down in Broadway.
Okay. There's a problem with terminology here that Dunn falls into, and that the entire metal scene has gone into, you know. And it's just because you can't think of another word that catches on doesn't mean that there's no other word that really exists. I mean, ELP, fine. Genesis, fine. Yes, fine. If that's prog, that's what I was anticipating the whole show would be. And there are a couple of other names in there. Okay, like Rush is perfect right there. Fine. But when you start to say Dillinger Escape Plan, King Crimson, Mastodon, Meshuggah, we're not talking prog. You just haven't been able to come up with a cool name for it. But the antecedents for those guys, if you want to talk to somebody, let's talk to In Silver Through Blood, the record where the cats in Neurosis finally said, you know, we're tired of doing 3-minute, 2-minute songs about the government, and we just want to, we have something else burning inside of us. And it was this whole kind of nativistic return to just super heavy, earthbound, ancient gods type stuff without being explicit about flutes and corsets and that kind of dragons and that kind of stuff.
And we'll come to all this, and I have a whole theory about this when it's time to talk about Tool. But let's start right, because Tool, I think, is the dividing line, and there's
except for the fact that the difference is, and these cats, I'm going back to my jazz vocalist, pop music, anti-vocalist thing, that the vocal that Tool was different because he can sing. He can sing, absolutely. Maynard could sing. And the cats from Meshuggah are also, even though there's a big difference between them and Napalm Death, he's tuneful in his screaming. So,
and that's, we'll talk about the whole grindcore, difference between grindcore and death metal on the next episode. But let's go ahead and get through the prog rock thing. So, I mean, there are obviously differences between King Crimson, Genesis, yes, everybody else. But I think they get to that. Let's lead with Genesis. Genesis is a hard one for me. The whole prog thing was a hard one for me. Being a self-described punk rock kid, my older brother was into prog rock. All I knew about it was I didn't like it. And I didn't give it a chance. I didn't listen to it. But then Buffalo 66 came out around 2000 and had a great, you know, the climactic shooting scene uses
spanning through time. We're spanning through time.
We are the zipping through our lives, and there was also a King Crimson ballad, and that made me go back to both of those bands. I'd always liked King Crimson more than the other ones, but I, you know, it's not like I had King Crimson albums or anything. And I went back
I think they were better, more interesting players, right?
Well, Yes was good players. And the thing about Yes is that they were pop songs. They were singing. Yep. Like, there's melodies and choruses and the whole bit. It's not just blah, 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 blah. You know, that's part of it. But there's hooks. And, you know, I was, when I went back and listened to the Yes albums, I was like, oh, okay, I get this. Like, some of it went Tales of Tropicanic Oceans or whatever.
Yeah.
Went way off the deep end. But the classic, I get why people like Yes. Genesis, I've never done the work.
Yeah. I'm biased against Genesis because a girlfriend was dumping me once, and she said, "Look, this song by Genesis will explain it all." and she transcribed the lyrics from The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. Is that a Genesis song? Yeah.
That's the big concept album Peter Gabriel ended his tenure
And that was supposed to explain to me precisely why she was dumping me.
Well, she should have just given you the finger and
said, what is that song about for those of us who aren't familiar with it?
Pretentious nonsense. I would say it's an extremely dense concept album that I haven't bothered to pin, and I don't want to diss it because Peter Gabriel's become Peter Gabriel. Genesis went on to have a big
sledgehammer.
Yeah, it's like somebody dumping you and you say, well, let's talk about this a bit, and then they give you some chewing gum.
Each chew represents your piercing my soul during the relationship and your salivation.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. So, personal grudges aside, we're trying to be fair here. Not our brand. The thing they leave out, though, there's a whole era of prog rock they leave out, which is prog essentially started with Sgt. Pepper's. And then there's the Moody Blues and Procol Harum and people who are listening to Giant. Yes. And people who are listening to Sgt. Pepper's Pet Sounds and Phil Spector stuff, and they're all these middle class British guys who went to music school, and they're like, I want to do this too. Some of them were like Steve Howe, and yes, he was in legit R&B bands, but he also had been taking lessons, and then, you know, as he developed, he was in a cool psychedelic band called Tomorrow. They also miss out that the jazz fusion was happening at the same time. So Miles Davis and Bitches Brew was a big, big deal. And all of these guys were listening to that stuff.
Yep.
They were not necessarily able to swing, but they were listening to that kind of stuff.
But there was a warring instinct. And I found, I was saying, are they going to say it? Are they going to say it? And then finally they said it. And one of the, I can't remember who it was that said it. He goes, hey man, we were intellectuals, you know? So this whole thing of like, oh, I'm going to do like the American blues, man, and drink myself into stupidity. You know, that there was a bifurcation there where some people were like, nah, that's all right. I don't have to, no thanks. And what's funny is you have Led Zeppelin. And why was Led Zeppelin so shitty to John Paul Jones all those years? Because John Paul Jones was one of those aforementioned, you know, intellectuals who was a hot shit studio guy during that time, right? And it was a little bit older than everybody else, if I'm remembering correctly. And
but he was also a working class guy. So he wasn't, he wasn't like these bands had people that went to Oxbridge, you know, Oxford and Cambridge. Genesis totally comes out of a public school. They also don't mention that Deep Purple was kind of the bridge between Prague and metal this whole time. I mean, Deep Purple did a whole album with a symphony orchestra.
Yeah, notable absence. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, they've already covered Deep Purple like 15 times. And then they get into King Crimson and they point out, okay, this is the one prog band that was heavy and loud. And the thing about King Crimson is they came along like right at the same time as Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. So if you were a rock fan at that time, here's a band with Marshall Stacks. They're loud as hell. It's heavy. You know, Greg Lake, great singer. You know, it was right in that same niche. Jimi Hendrix loved King Crimson. Jimi Hendrix almost tried out for Emerson, Lake and Palmer at one point, which, you know, shows you Jimmy was very lost. But, you know, such as it was. Anyway, they talk about King Crimson. They get the dark and evil aspect of that. And then they segue to Rush. And they kind of collapse the time because all the prog rock, British prog rock stuff is basically happening from like 69 to 73. Mm-hmm. Rush really doesn't, like, I think their first album was 73, but they don't really hit their stride till like 76, 77. So Rush is this later thing. And on the chart, they've got like Styx and Kansas in there too, because there's this whole Heartland prog rockin' bands thing going on. Because, you know, and that Rush sort of fit into. And go ahead.
I'm just saying that one of the things they missed too that was big about Rush and I thought was understated was the iconography.
Yep.
You know, I saw the pentagram and the searcher on, and also their bona fides were a friend of mine named Paul Dardal was a hardcore guy, hardcore music, the hardest of hardcore guys, was a Rush roadie for years. That was a guy they chose to be their like stage manager and Rush roadie. He and I used to run up and down the boardwalk in Jersey fighting guys. This was the guy that Rush. So Rush had a foot in. You know, it wasn't like namby-pamby kind of.
No. And like their first album, and what made them was they were meathead rockers that went over in Cleveland. Yep. And Cleveland was the rock city. Yeah, right. Like Cleveland and Detroit were, you know, that's where the sweaty, long-haired, hard rocking bands, you know, made their bona fides. And also bands like the MC5 and Velvet Underground were big in those towns too. And so, you know, open to a lot of stuff, but Rush gets Neil Peart. They add Neil Peart, who was on their first album, and they get progressively proggier and proggier. And like they said, they basically didn't know what they were doing until their fourth album, like 2112. But 21, I mean, like I spent decades hating Rush and making fun of everybody listening to Rush, but also they were my favorite band in fourth grade. I mean, I think you got to respect Rush for what they are. They're massively.
Well, the weird thing about Rush, what should have been noted is that I hated early Rush too. And then when did I start to like Rush? It wasn't so much the musical change. It was like the rings on a tree. It was like when Geddy Lee's voice started to change as a result of him getting older, I could suddenly stand it, you know?
A lot of people are turned off by Geddy Lee's screechy, high-pitched voice. That is extremely
very Dungeons and Dragons. The kind of person that you think would personify like a D&D player going into rock music is what Geddy Lee, but Rush had.
But it changed. It changed.
Yeah.
I take your word for it.
Yeah. Well, there's like a distinct period, and they talk about that. Like in 1980, they put out Permanent Waves, and they made the same. They're listening to The Police, and The Police were old art rock guys who cut their hair and dyed it blonde and pretended to be punk. And sort of did reggae, but mostly used new technology to sound different and new. Mm-hmm. Not here to diss The Police, not an especially big fan, but
better not diss them.
Colossally huge. And
unless you want to be a spirit in the material world.
That's right. And Rush followed that path. ZZ Top followed that path too. It was
watch
like,
it.
Hey, they did. They got synthesizers and they updated their stuff, used drum machines, changed their sound for the 80s.
Brought
in a new bass player and singer and did the same thing with Trevor Robin and you know,
it's easy to use a drum machine when your drummer is passed out in the corner.
Well, you know, but drum machines was the sound at the time, and you know, 80s was also big and around, but that's a sidetrack. That's just kind of like what Rush was very popular and successful at, but they lost their metal following, and they say as much. Like they went in a different direction into this kind of pop. I don't know exactly. There's not really a term for it. I mean, 80s art rock. Would you call it?
I wouldn't call it art rock.
It's not artsy, but it's a bunch of ex art rockers made.
Talking Heads was like art rock, right? And Blondie.
Yeah, Talking Heads. Art rock is a deceptive thing.
Vice magazine calls Oxbow the world's greatest art rock band, and I never liked that.
Yeah, art rock is so broad because it's anybody who went to art school can be called art rock,
or
anybody who's got an intellectual, you know, some kind of intellectual pretensions, and that's the thing, and that's where we'll get to the big split.
Intellectual,
but is there's. The thing with this intellectualism is that people like Chris Squire and Yes is not somebody I would call an intellectual. I would call him middlebrow. It's not like he's reading.
That's because you're a snob.
Literature. I am a snob, and that's the big split, and that's where Tool is going to come in and change things, because this coterie of groups were all the kind of people who wanted sophisticated music, were intellectually open, but they wanted the notes played right. They weren't interested in any kind of dissonance. They weren't interested, you know, it's like there was this big split between the Velvet Underground and Frank Zappa in the mid-60s. And people aren't necessarily connecting the dots, but all of these guys, every one of these prog rock bands was heavy into Zappa. Zappa pointed the way with his Freak Out. It was the first double album in rock. Yeah. One of the first bands that had like legit composer. To me, Frank Zappa is not a rocker at all. He's a would-be modernist composer who used a rock band to do his pieces. And it took, you know, like, and it's also with this layer of smarmy satire on top, and that's what which got always, him over.
Which irked me to no end, and I found it boring. And my favorite story though is with Lou Reed asked Diamanda Galas to sing with him, and she's like, "I'm not going to sing with you. You can't even keep a note." And he's like, "Some of us don't think keeping a note is that important." She goes, "Really? If your guitar player shows up tonight and plays all of the wrong notes, you probably..."
Frozen.
Okay, but the big split I wanted to get to was Frank Zappa versus the Velvet Underground. East Coast, West Coast, they were both seen as artsy bands that both had legit classical people. Like John Cage went to Fancy Pants. John Cale went to legit.
God, I'm doing a show with amateurs.
Hey, I'm an old man. I get these names wrong. But John Cale went to legit classical music school, and he was studying with modernist classic composers like John Cale, like Philip Glass, et cetera, et cetera. Cale was legit, and Zappa was legit.
Have Cale for lunch, man. Maybe that's what happened. Uh-huh. Or you should have more kale on your diet.
They had both studied modernist composers, but the thing was they were studying different modernist composers, and it was like oil and water, and Cale was into dissonance and improvisation and noise and droning, and Zappa was into very precise, you know, lots of notes and very precise and virtuosic and get it right and play it perfectly, whereas the Velvet Underground was about, you know, improvise and wild and playing with amateurs. It was very much the way John Coltrane would recruit amateurs during his free jazz period. So it's oil and water. But to me, like, the Velvet Underground are what I would consider highbrow, and Zappa's more like middlebrow. And so these guys are, and that implies this hierarchy that I don't think is necessarily fair or valid, but that's the distinction. And then when the next piece of the episode talks about Dream Theater and Queensryche, which are very much in the same tradition, and they found that even though this kind of prog stuff was very passe and very out of favor in the 80s, there was still a big market for it. And I wasn't a Queensryche fan, but my metalhead college roommate loved him, and I respected his musical opinions. It wasn't necessarily what I was into, but we had lots of stuff we both liked, and then we had stuff I liked he didn't like, he had stuff he liked I didn't. But if he
Queensryche still had their foot in the street, they were like,
their first album was metal. They were metal, and then they go in this prog direction, do this concept album. If you're into that, they were the best thing going at that time. I wasn't into that, but I'm going to defer to the people who are into that stuff that were saying, "Hey, Queensryche, this is the shit. They're better than Marillion or whoever the other bands that were trying to
hardcore that
niche at the time." Yeah, they had an album called Fugazi. And then Dream Theater goes in that same direction, but is heavier. Each of these bands get heavier as the metal just gets heavier and heavier through this period. So Queensryche is heavier than Rush was, Dream Theater is heavier than Queensryche was, but it's still coming from that ethos, the same place that Genesis or Yes were coming from. King Crimson was a little bit more intellectually adventurous, I would say, had some more of that stuff. But Fripp kind of had feet in both camps. I mean, he was in a band with Greg Lake. He was in a band with John Wetton, who later, forms Asia. He was in a band with Bill Bruford of Yes, was in King Crimson for a while. So, there's a lot of overlap, but Fripp's also playing with Brian Eno and David Bowie and stuff like that. So,
I'm disappointed, though, in the latter half of it, which we'll, I'm sure, talk about later, that they didn't touch on how influential Swans were. And they were introduced to me by Rollins, and he said, "It's like Sabbath without all the stupid shit." And I thought, I got to hear something that sounds... That's how Swans were introduced to me,
heavier than Swans, to me, were introduced because I heard them on a big sound system waiting for a show to come on, and I was like, what is this? This is the heaviest shit I have ever heard in my life. But
which was still pretty correct.
But that was this punk underground thing that was descended from the Velvet Underground and the noise rock. Yeah. And so, they could have talked about the Swans, but my big epiphany with this, and we'll get to Tool in the second half of this, but that, because I'd never listened to Tool. Tool was like, I was in a heavy rock band in 91. I don't know. We started 91, 92. And I just hit a point where I was like, I play this all the time. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to buy. I'm not interested in new metal bands. I'm not interested in new punk bands. I'm in one, you know.
This is the beginning of the end for Nate. That's what we could do. Mark it as the beginning of the end.
Pretty much. I mean, I stopped obsessively following new music for like 20 years and really enjoyed just chilling and picking up, you know, being a casual and just, oh, if something came across my path, I'd listen to it. So that means I didn't pay any attention to hard rock because that was my home native genre. And I was burned out on it. And so Tool and Korn were the first wave of bands, and Rage Against the Machine were all like, these would be bands I would be all over. And I'm not. I'm just not going to check them out. So it's been fun for me to go back and check this out. But with Tool, I was expecting this kind of Dream Theater type stuff. And I wasn't hearing any of that. It, like, the kids and the wife thought it was just grunge. I was like, "What? How would you describe this music?" No, that's grunge. But if you listen to the vocals and everything, and if you play them, mix them in with Soundgarden and the Melvins.
But see, the problem is I went down to Tijuana to see Rollins. So the Rollins band is playing when they finally, he had Henrietta Collins and the wife beating Child Haters, which was his first post Black Flag thing, which sucked. And then he said, no, I got this thing, and it was a Rollins band, which is actually pretty good. So I go to TJ to see them. Who's opening? I don't know, some band called Tool. And I thought, as soon as Tool finished playing, I was like, oh, man, that's rough. Having to do a whole tour with these guys when it was pretty clear they were going to be huge. I did not envy Rollins having to go out there every single night. And it seemed to me like a tour that he wouldn't have consciously chosen, that some label people said, hey, we got a good idea. It's like, yeah, you know, I like competition as well as anybody else, but I'm not having Tool open for us every night. That's ridiculous.
Well, especially at that point, because Rollins was running out the end of the string of the Rollins band. But Rollins band is something.
No. This was at the beginning of the Rollins band. This is right after the end of Silence or Wait, one of those. I can't remember which.
Middle of the way through, but
no.
I mean, they already put out multiple albums. Okay, well, but
now they had.
There will be a reckoning in part two.
Rollins band is somebody I would put in the category of precursor to Tool as well. But there's a whole coterie of bands. Swans is one. I think Melvins is the big one, though. I think Melvins is absolutely the influential one. That Melvins, because of their influence on the grunge scene, because all the bands, Green River, Soundgarden, all those bands, Nirvana, worshiped the Melvins, studied the Melvins. And the funny thing about the Melvins is, the crowds that loved grunge hated the Melvins. Like they played, they opened for so many of these bands that they had mentored and tutored just to get booed off stage and humiliated. Damn. It happened over and over again because Buzz is not a charismatic frontman. They're not a vocal centered band. You know, they don't do,
crowds. We played with them a bunch and then we had a problem with them, which I'll talk about in another show, but you know, then I'm still friends with kind of Dale and had a run-in with Buzz. But the reality of it was, I think that I've come to be a fan because Shuffle and Melvins comes up and every single time they came up, I get across and go, who the hell is this? I go across the room. It was a Melvins. He's actually a great singer. And I think that's what finally.
He is, but it's not pop singing. It's not pop singing. Correct. It is rock singing, but the thing is, Melvin's big number one influence is Captain Beefheart. And Beefheart, even though he came up with Zappa, they literally grew up together and both played together, are very different because Beefheart's on that artsy side of things, the ugly, more the free jazz side of things rather than modern neoclassicism, whatever. So it's weird.
It's like Quake and Quist. I happen to be a Beefheart guy.
Yeah, me too. And the Melvins was the band my band ripped off. Like that was, and so when I was listening to Tool, I was like, well, this is complicated. This is weird. These time signatures are changing. I was like, some of these licks sound like licks my band could have been playing. And I was like, but we didn't listen to prog rock. And then I was like, aha, it's the Melvins. And that's sort of this change. And also the thing that happened after grunge got over is the bright line between, are you a punk or are you a classic rocker? No longer existed. People didn't care about that stuff anymore. And so people were free to bring in all these kinds of influences. And we'll talk about, you know, the math rock aspect. Now, what else did you have to say about Queensrÿche and Dream Theater that you wanted to insist that we cover on this time?
Mostly Jason Slater, who was in, I think the name of the band was Black River Conspiracy or Black Snake, something like that. And he had been in Third Eye Blind, wrote a lot of their big hits, but he was also a guy from East Palo Alto here. He just died. And he opened for Tool. And he also had something to do with the production team of Latter-day Queensryche. And so they were also, like I said, they had their ear to the streets. He was a pretty phenomenal contribution. And my favorite story about going on tour with Tool was that Maynard, because of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, kept challenging him to roll. Jason was a BJJ blue belt, as was Maynard at that time. And he said, no. And then finally, their crew guys ganged up on Jason and said, you're going to roll. He goes, I got to play. He goes, you're going to roll, you pussy. And so then he rolled and tapped Maynard.
Wow. I see.
Okay, that's good. And then we kind of got disadvised. I go, what? He goes, yeah, they kind of did it, really.
So, I see. But that's Tool, not Queensryche or Dream Theater.
Correct.
So no, did you have anything to add about Dream?
Jason Slater was part of the production team, unless you just want to keep talking. I can just stop.
No. So he was part of the production team for Dream, for Queensryche. Okay.
Queensryche. And he had lots of great things to say about those guys. And again, to me, like, what changes is their bona fides, right? And I felt that way with Tool, that though I like Tool, these were not hardcore guys. These are not guys who grew up listening to Black Flag and all that stuff. With Queensryche, were very much hardcore guys who decide, well, I can really sing.
Not hardcore punk.
According to Jason, like, they were there at the Black Flag show, and that's what Jason said. That's what he said.
Well, they might have been at the shows, but their music and their material shows.
I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about their placement in time and their understanding. You know, when Maynard was going to Rush shows, these guys were actually, you know, in the pit punching people in the face. Just a small thing.
I don't know. That doesn't jive at all.
Well, I don't know. Why do we ask John Cage Keller?
All right. Well, we'll continue, and we'll talk about Tool, and we'll talk about Meshuggah, and we'll talk about Dillinger Escape Plan when we come back.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Continue our discussion of prog metal into the 90s and 2000s. But before we get into Tool at all, I want to go back and mention Jethro Tull and Pink Floyd as two other first-generation prog bands that rocked that should have been mentioned in the conversation. I mean, some of this is the bands bringing up Genesis, but Pink Floyd, I think, and Jethro Tull deserve the shine as much as anybody.
Why didn't they get it?
I don't know. I mean, Jethro Tull had the flute and the whole thing, so that kind of put a stink on him. And also, they won the Best Metal Grammy in like '89 when it was, just disgustingly inappropriate. Yeah. So I think people have kind of held that against him. But if you go back and listen to their stuff, I mean, Locomotive Breath and stuff like that, they had some chugga chugga guitars and were generally heavier than Genesis, I would say, and did massive concept albums. Like Thick as a Brick is a one song album, you know, and like Pink Floyd had the Nile song and some other heavy things. That the Necros did a good version of the Nile song, but
what? Who did?
The Necros. Late, really? Late in their career. Yeah. And that Tangled Up album, I think.
Single, on the B-side. I stopped listening to them by then, but yeah, all right. You know, Conquest for Death was my favorite record of those.
The album that Touch and Go has kept out of print for 37 years now, yeah, for petty reasons. But that's got nothing to do with prog metal, so people come to listen to us talk about prog metal don't want to hear about hardcore punk. So Queensryche, Dream Theater, anything we need to say? I mean, that we
no, we discussed them last show. Come on, let's
okay,
get to
okay, okay. Well, I just settle. But the two bands that should have mentioned in this era and didn't were Voivod and Primus. And I don't know if you can call Primus metal, but they were playing a lot of the same venues, and they were definitely proggy. You know, they were on Lollapalooza and all that kind of stuff. And Voivod
and they made the Tony Hawk soundtrack.
that they did. And then, you know, I actually listened to not one but two Dream Theater albums all the way through. Not my personal taste, but I was pleasantly surprised. They do rock harder, I mean remarkably harder than say Queensryche, but still
this was a naming gambit that went wrong. Dream Theater is the name of a record. Dream Theater is the name of a song. The Dream Theater is not the name of a band. That's somebody should have helped them with that. You know?
Well, I think they did fine career-wise. Although the thing I want to bring out about them is they're a music college band, so Berklee School of Music. Yeah,
you can't really hold that against them, though, man. If you do, you remember going to L.A. in the big hair days, and you would see all those GIT guys, man.
Guitarist Institute of Technology. Yes, yes, yeah. They were studying their tapping. Speaking of Genesis, but yeah, I mean, Berklee College Music is fine and dandy, whatever. But I don't know. My big thing with Dream Theater is I honestly don't think they had any influence. I don't, you know, this whole wave of the rest of the bands I talk about are not following the Dream Theater lead. Like, I think Dream Theater and Queensryche were a dead end, and then Tool.
Was it his personal favorites? That's why I put them in there?
No, I think if you're going to talk about prog metal, you have to talk about them because they were the only exemplars of that style other than Voivod for, you know, 5-10 years. I mean, there was nobody else doing anything like what Queensryche was doing there. And it was very much in the footsteps of Rush. So my bigger problem with the prog metal thing is, like, now, you know, we've got Tool. We already talked about Tool. And you're right about the noise rock thing. It's not just the Melvins. It's that whole Shellac, Steve Albini's band, the Swan, Sonic Youth. I mean,
oh, I'm sorry. Did you acknowledge that I was right about something?
I did. I'm not even going to bring up how dumb your point about Queensryche going to a Black Flag show was, but out of kindness.
That was solid. having been there, that was solid.
But the point that they made in the show was that there was a niche for this kind of stuff, and there kind of always had been, and it's always kids who are learning how to play guitar and want to see guys who can play fast. I want to see a drummer with a gong and 80 tom toms, and you know. So Dream Theater and Queensryche were.
Do you know anybody who doesn't play an instrument who's into Mahavishnu?
Mahavishnu Orchestra?
Yeah.
I mean, I love them.
You play an instrument.
Yeah, I know, but so I can't really comment that. But Mahavishnu isn't this kind of same kind of stuff. I mean, Black Flag was in the Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Yeah, no, but I'm
glad you brought them up because there's somebody else we should have talked about. I mean, they were heavy rock, but instrumental and also jazz fusion, but way heavy rock. I mean, blazing guitar solos, loud, aggressive, and everything. But I don't think they have the same meathead appeal as, say, Rush or Dream Theater or whatever, you know?
Maybe. Like, I know a lot of heavy metal drummers and bass players are huge into them. Harley from the Cro-Mags, huge Mahavishnu guy. Oxbow's first drummer, Tom Doro, huge Mahavishnu guy. Yeah, he's got a, you know, I found him unlistenable myself, but.
Really? I dug him. I mean, it's guitar wavery, but.
I'm just a singer. What do I
know? I see. Well, what do you think of, like, the process of weeding out?
I didn't mind that. I mean that was always sold for me on Petty Bond. But you know what I did was excited about, and I'm not sure if you got the same press release I got. I listened to Graham Bonnet's new record, and it's great.
You're back to the Alcatraz.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. I just got it. And I listened to the whole thing this week, and I was like, "This is solid." I don't care, man. It was easier for him to replace Yngwie than it was for Yngwie to replace him, and that's where I'm resting there.
Yngwie never did have a strong vocalist again. That is true. Yeah. But let's keep moving. Meshuga. They talk about, you know, Swedish prog metal band, but to me, Meshuga was always part of that Swedish extreme metal scene, like death metal with Entombed and all that kind of stuff. I didn't see them as prog per se. When you listen to them, you can tell they're doing fancy stuff.
Yeah, but I don't.
To me, like, thrash and death metal bands are kind of prog anyway, you know? But the Ornette Coleman comparison left me scratching my head. You can't improvise in a context like Meshuga. Am I wrong? I mean, if you're playing that kind of complicated rhythms, there's no room for free to play free. So, I mean, they're aggressive.
You should. There's an interview I put up on my Facebook where they talked to the guitar player from the fairly famous guitar player from Boonwell. Of course, that's his slumming project, the Boonwell thing, and he talks about highly structured music and improvisational spaces within that highly structured music. So, you know, there's a possibility, a strong possibility.
Yeah. Maybe so. I'd be curious to know if Meshuggah's actually into Ornette Coleman or any kind of jazz.
But more like Albert Eiler. I don't know if you've ever seen him play.
Oh, I mean, he was ice-picked and tied to a pinball machine before I was born, but I love Albert Eiler, you know.
Yeah.
But I've never heard them, like, sit on the most dissonant note combo possible and just drag it for the whole tune.
A buddy of mine saw them and he was like, oh, these people, you know, anytime a black guy pulls out a horn, they think, oh, it's going to be some smooth. So Eiler takes his horn out and just, they lasted about 30 seconds, man. They couldn't take
it.
So.
I love Albert Eiler and Sonny Sherrick and that whole school of, you know, jazz noise. Yep, harmonic. But then that brings us to the Dillinger Escape. Anybody else have anything to say about Meshuggah? Yeah, I mean, this stuff leaves Alexi ice cold. Has no comment about any of this. But Dillinger Escape Plan.
But we're not tastemakers.
Dillinger Escape Plan, though, is a whole different kettle of fish. Like, I don't even buy them as metal. That's definitely aggressive rock. But to me, I would consider it like math rock, like Shellac or Slint or Shudder to Think. That tradition. Yeah.
No. There's a whole different, and they're post Dillinger projects with Ben doing that stuff with Giraffe Tongue, with some Cantrell and some of those guys, and then Greg Pucciato doing actually on tour with Alice in Chains, doing several songs during the set. It's pretty clear to me that their ideation of themselves is as a heavy rock, you know, metal band.
Heavy rock, yeah, but I mean. Shellac,
I consider them a hardcore band myself. So
yeah, to me, it's coming out of the punk tradition, not the metal tradition.
Yeah,
not that there's much difference in that at this point. And then we got Mastodon, and going back to Mastodon, my impression, which I hadn't dived into them, but that they were a doom metal band, and then the prog thing. Yeah, they're totally a doom. They can niche into that.
I don't feel so about it. Yeah, I can see that.
You know, and so, which kind of makes me, you know, like, and they don't talk about doom metal in the extreme metal episode, which we're going to talk about next. So, and I could get that Sleep isn't like selling, you know, gazillions of units or whatever, but that was my favorite genre of metal in the 90s. So, and stoner rock.
Stoner rock, yeah, Stoner.
Fu Manchu, you know, that kind of stuff, super heavy, and yep, and Caius, and you know, and then that of course turns into Queens. What is it, Stone Age? Something Queens of the Stone Age? Yeah.
Eagles of the Stone Age.
No, that's Eagles of Death Metal is the another related project.
Queens of the Stone Age, yeah, that was pop.
That was pop, but it came out of that sort of sludge metal thing, and they talk about it. So, I don't know. Any final thoughts on prog metal? We're just going to make this a short episode.
No,
like it.
How was it that we just skipped by Tool? We're like Tool. We didn't even talk.
Yeah,
about
that was very disturbing.
I thought we were talking about Tool last time. I mean, like
no, we were supposed to talk about Tool this time.
I see. Well, my take on Tool is that they were a grunge band who did proggy things, but really weren't any proggier than Soundgarden. I mean, okay, they were a little proggier than Soundgarden, but not. Yeah. Soundgarden's pretty proggy if you actually listen.
Hands all over.
I mean, they had the Jarl, they had the grunge Jarl up front, but the guitars and the song structures and everything are.
Well, this is the thing that Greg Davis pointed out, the Oxbow drummer, and after we did the show with Perfect Circle, and he was like, "These guys, I guarantee you, 10 years ago, they weren't listening to what we're listening to, you know." And you know, 10 years earlier, he was right. Maynard was in the military, right? They was listening to Rush and Queensryche, and you know, pretty middle what we would consider middle of the road metal, you know. So
Maynard probably, but the rest. I mean, at some point, they were listening to grunge in a big way. I mean,
maybe. But then you also realize the guys in Soundgarden 10 years earlier weren't listening to grunge, right? They were listening to.
They were into the Melvins. I mean, the Melvins were kind of like a lodestar for them, you know. And most of them were listening to Black Flag. Like that's where the Melvins, you know,
which were nobody would have ever building them. Would have ever called anything. I mean, even though that tour in '84 when they started growing their hair and we said we're going to be hippies now, start listening to a lot of Grateful Dead to alienate their fans. And yeah, that's, I have to say, honest to God, Rollins gave me a tape, and that's what I listened to the summer of '84. Nothing but Holy Diver. He goes, "This is all we've listened to in the van this whole tour." I was, let me hear it, and that's all I listened to that whole summer. So, but I think that it's just, you know, it's what you listened to before. So I think, in other words, I think Tools in its conception, actualization, its basis in reality was always mainstreaming, and I don't know if that's a bad thing. It's just is what it is, you know.
I can see that, but it doesn't read like square 80s metal to me. It's updated for the 90s, which, you know, it but
no, and they had an edge to them, you know. I mean, you got to take hats off to a guy who's doing a song called "Prison Rape," you know. I mean, I've heard Albini just lambast them. I think I can't remember whether he was lambasting them as a band or as the video or but he's not, apparently not that much of a fan. So he clearly is hearing what Greg Davis is hearing, but you know. I enjoyed them. I saw them in Tijuana and enjoyed them. Thought they blew Rollins off the stage, and the structural stuff didn't stand in the way of what I felt to be good tunes. You know,
that's the thing. They're tune focused. They're not twiddly twiddly diddly diddly. You know, they're doing that underneath, but in the service of the tune.
Then they took that left turn where people, as they inevitably do, make the big mistake of listening to the singer too much. And Maynard started I'm the first to say, as a singer, I'm the first to say we need to shut up more. And he went down that Frank Zappa road, man, where it was just, it was like the same stupid inside joke that you didn't really quite get. But like Benny Hill, if you just kind of aligned it to pee pee poopy caca, then it was like pictures of him sitting on the toilet, and you know, it's just Jesus Christ, what's the matter with you? How old are you? You know, so. But I know I had to have that conversation about the Melvins, right? Because we played with them, and I'm a huge fan of Dale's. But I've been at loggerheads for Buzz for no good reason, except he just walked in the dressing room when Oxbow's first drummer was talking shit about him. I mean, what am I going to say? You know, he's talking shit. I said, what is it they do with this thing they're doing with the photos? And they came up in San Francisco around Fungo Mungo and Primus and all that kind of goof rock. I go, what is it? Why? What's happening? And so I asked Scott Kelly from Neurosis, is it just the way he is, or is he trying to do? He goes, hey man, it's just the way Buzz is. Like, he thinks that shit's funny. Like, it's funny. Like, Godspeed You Black Emperor curated a festival, and you know who they got to play the festival? The biggest get for them, the thing that they were, Godspeed You Black Emperor, the biggest thing, who are pretty prog in their own right, the biggest get for them, which they got, was Weird Al Yankovic.
Interesting choice.
Do
people buy festival tickets to see Weird Al live? Like, but I know. You know, speaking of Weird Al, I was playing Voivod in the car today, and my kid hated it. And I was like, "Wow, this is way worse than I remembered it." The dude sings just like Weird Al Yankovic. It's stunning. Yeah, Voivod. There was some painful listening for this, and some treats. I enjoyed getting into Meshuggah. I enjoyed Mastodon. I even enjoyed Tool. That I've, you know, never cracked a Tool open, Tool album open in my life, and I went through three or four of them, and you know, yeah, it seems pretty solid stuff. I mean, you know, and the younger metal guys that I talked to about it, Tool is very highly regarded, you know. So, I mean,
where are you hanging out with younger metal guys? Where's that?
On Twitter, these MMA dorks, they're all metalheads. All these guys arrive for me, and you know. Like,
I thought you were hanging out at schoolyards or something. Hey, you young kids.
No, I'm on Reddit and Twitter. I'm not talking to people. I mean,
just lurking.
just lurking. So Alexi could barely stomach the episode.
No, you know, I think one of my problems with it is Rush was a group when I was growing up. Always, no matter where you went, somebody had the denim jacket with a Rush album cover, like, you know, drawn in ink. So there always was someone with Rush. It just getting these voices, and he looked exactly the way he sounded, and it was just, I just could not. I like Tom Sawyer like everybody else that was a casual, but even then it was just too. I think I go back to other things with metal is the fact that, and which is why I like Tool, is when you have a certain kind of darkness and a certain kind of edge to your sound. And if it gets a little too Stonehenge, like Spinal Tap, and a little too just nasal and high pitched, and I hear the pan flutes, and if I'm looking at you and you look like you belong in a Renaissance festival, or I'm getting those kind of vibes, just, you know what I'm saying? It's like that kind of stuff. But for the episode, the reason why I had a problem with the episode also is because I think it just was going all over the place in terms of sounds. Like, sometimes, again, as a casual, as someone's not a musician, whenever there's certain genres or subgenres he's picking, there's stuff he leaves out. But there's, you know, sonically, just as a pure casual, I can follow the sound. You know, I can follow how the music sounds, the singers, the vibe. This is all over the place. And so Rush is on there. I'm like, I can't watch this. So I'm like fast forwarding. And then I get it something else. I'm like, hey, this sounds totally different from that. All right. And then they have Queensryche, which I was during the time, like, you could not avoid Silent Lucidity and all that kind of stuff that crossed. Again, as a pure casual, you just could not avoid. Yeah. Queensryche was like, oh, that's the metal that's respectable. That's respectable pop metal, right? Like, at the time, it was that group that if you wanted to impress someone and not be embarrassed to be a metal fan, it's like, I listen to Queensryche. Oh, they're kind of like Pink Floyd and Rush. And so you see that, and then they get to Tool, and I'm waiting, and it's like, yeah, they didn't agree to participate, obviously. And I was like, okay, how far along could go with this? And they couldn't use music. And then it's like they're in and out, and it's like, okay. And then they're moving on to other stuff, which sounds, it just, there's nothing. And again, I am not a prog metal guy, so again, I'm just a casual, but it's just really hard to follow. It just seemed like he was just throwing shit out there with people who do interviews with him.
So yeah, I kind of got that vibe too, because like, it's not like, I mean, Dillinger Escape Plan, I could see an argument for why they're significant, but it's not like they're massively popular or part of a movement.
Yes, it were.
Has anything to do with, say, well, not a movement that includes Meshuggah and Mastodon. I mean,
Those guys are known associates and fellow travelers. They had 3 sold out shows at a huge venue in New York when they announced that they were leaving. They were pretty massive, man. Those guys need not work again, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they were big, but they weren't Black Sabbath big, you know? They weren't Linkin Park big, and they were not linked. I do not think of Dillinger Escape Plan and Meshuggah, you know, like, it's not like Meshuggah led to Dillinger Escape Plan, or like, I just,
right, like, or even it's funny you said that, and then also we say, like, you know? And when you say as big, exactly, bands that you like, and you say as big, because with other stuff, even if I was not familiar with, you can see and understand, oh, that's why this is big. You know, this, oh, I get this now. I understand why this is here. But this is like just a dartboard of stuff, like just all over the place, just more than any other. If this was the blueprint for every episode, then by this point I would understand it. But this just totally veered off in terms of any kind of coherent thread for somebody that was not familiar, that was like just had a very basic understanding of the genre. It was just too all over the place, hard to follow, hard to understand the pieces of the puzzle. It just seemed like throwing it all over the place.
This one and Shock Rock were like sort of non-temporal episodes. They're not organized by time, they're organized by style. And you could take the groups that were in the Shock Rock for the most part and put them into other episodes, you know, like you could have put Slipknot into the new metal episode just fine. And new metal was the dominant style for most of the period we're talking about here, you know, at least in the 80s and 90s, massive, massive genre. And so prog metal is kind of, and from the beginning, from the time of Rush, it was sort of an alternative style. It was never the dominant style.
But big, though, that's the thing. I guess, but that's the problem, is the fact that as a pure casual, I'm telling you, like, Rush, of all the groups they had in the metal evolution, huge in terms of commercially, Queensryche, huge. So you know, so you're having, at the end of the where they're with what inspired them, you know. So again, it's not like it's this little total underground, non-commercial groups that they're playing.
But it wasn't the dominant strain.
Right. No, that's true. Right. That's true. You had hardcores for the music. That's true. Because that's for the Rush thing.
And Tool, I think you could easily have put into the grunge episode. Because to me, they were like, if the thing was all the other second wave grunge bands sucked. So that, you know, Tool had musical ideas and power. So I can see why they didn't stick them in there with Candlebox and Nickelback and shit, but that was the sort of the audience they were fishing in, is people that were into grunge bands. That's kind of who was in a Tool. So, you know, throwing Meshuggah and Dillinger Escape Plan and Mastodon in there, it's like they do have this prog aspects to them, but it just didn't entirely hang together to me as a coherent episode. It's not talking about an era, because they weren't the dominant style of any particular era, and then they all have these different strains on them. And
you know what? Who they should have put in there that I think they missed the boat. They should have actually put Neurosis in there, because Neurosis had.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
That's pretty consistent, and because to me, prog, it's not really prog unless there's a keyboard. And Neurosis, since what is that first record that they had where they Silver and Blood? I'm pretty sure they've had keyboards since then. You know, I mean, I know the dude, so yeah, he's had keyboards since then. So,
well, you notice in this episode that after Tool, there's no more keyboards. Like, once Tool comes along, like, I swear, the whole Queensryche Dream Theater line died. I mean, Dream Theater was the last of the breed. They did show there was a market for prog metal, and, you know, there's a big Reddit prog metal group, but and they talk about a lot of these bands, but I don't know. To me, it just doesn't hold together as well as the style. And so next time it'll be interesting to talk about extreme metal, because you got multiple different styles, you know, with the death metal and the black metal and grindcore, which is an interesting one because it comes out of punk.
But do they have the true godfather of extreme metal, which is Gary Cherone and his I mean, the group's name was Extreme, right?
Yeah, it's, man.
You know, that's
I mean, he was a singer for Van Halen.
So. Oh God, I forgot about that sad chapter. Oh,
thank you. My contribution to this episode.
So we got extreme metal to look forward to, but it seems like metalcore is the dominant metal style of the 21st century, which kind of comes out of, you know, I don't know. It's like this thing, and Eugene, you're probably familiar. Remember in the 90s when you'd hear about, hey, have you heard the Donnas? They're this chick punk band. And
I remember that. Them,
and they sound like Motley Crue and AC/DC.
Mm. They started, you know? They were called Raggedy Ann. They were Pally High girls, and they came to us to record with their parents in tow. And the guy, Bart Thurber, who ran the studio, was like, man, they're going to be huge. I go, you're out of your fucking mind. And, of course, I'm frozen. Oh, no, there, I'm back. Of course, he was right. Not only was he right, the guy who ran Universal Records in Europe, in Hamburg, a guy named Michael Krell, came to me and said, hey, Eugene, we're thinking about signing the Donnas. What do you think? They suck it. This is the guy who signed Rammstein. Well, they signed the Donnas, and they did huge business over in Europe. And so he stopped asking me for advice at that point, right?
But, and that's, you know, smart business. Any A&R man will make that.
Yeah, screw that. I never liked him, man. I liked the women in the band. But
the point I was trying to make, though, is that the definition of punk sounded like 80s metal to me, not punk. And honestly, it seems like New York hardcore, like Sick of It All,
Man
and Cro-Mags and all and Dropkick Murphys and all this stuff, that becomes a more dominant influence on metal in the 21st century than almost any of this other stuff.
Biohazard, yeah.
Yeah, and what they call metalcore now, which I don't have a super firm handle on, but that seems to be the strain. So you could argue that they should have done more on, you know, punk metal crossover in the series, but we'll talk. I think they'll talk about that some in extreme metal. It's been about a year since I watched that episode, so I'm gonna go tonight and watch that. But that's what we'll talk about next time as we wrap up our discussion of Metal Evolution.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi return to close out the series with a look at extreme metal. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.